Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is episode 13 for May 26th. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week. This podcast is designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories have more information at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. Editorial. The release of the Crime Think piece on informants that you'll hear more about later reminds me that for a long time I have been interested in the question of how to protect ourselves from cops, not only on the streets, but also in the cop shops. People have a knee-jerk reaction to the question of informing or snitching or whatever. The reaction is, don't do it, which is fine as far as it goes. Obviously, I'm not denying that straight-up snitching happens, where people become convinced that they have to give information on others to protect themselves. But I also strongly suspect that the cops call it that when it's more complicated, or when people haven't done it at all. More to the point of this editorial, I have heard too many stories of people with good intentions who have given information when they didn't want to, or allowed the cops to take too much information, purely from a lack of preparation. Most people make it sound like it's easy not to talk. Like being scared, disoriented, confused, and lied to shouldn't make any difference, that we always know the best thing to do and can always do it. Sometimes that's true. Usually, that attitude minimizes the difficulty of behaving the ways we want to in these situations. One of my heroes is a person who has been kicked out of multiple European countries. Each time he was interrogated, and every time he's given so little information that they could not even tell he was an American. Unfortunately, when I ask him about tips, he looks at me like I'm crazy, as if it should come naturally to everyone. I do remember him mentioning that he turned his chair around once and straddled it, instead of sitting properly. Maybe those kinds of minor things become significant steps in reminding ourselves that we have choices. Another person I know with a track record of dealing appropriately with cops is someone who acts friendly to them sometimes. His Texas accent probably helps with this to some extent, but so does knowing the line between when it's most effective to be friendly and smile and when it's best to tell a cop to fuck off. I don't think on my feet that fast, so I've thought a lot about training programs to teach people how to shut the fuck up, and or how to remember all the things we've heard in friendly circles, but that leave our minds when confronted by sneaky, trained, scary, friendly, manipulative, lying cops, FBI agents, etc. In my more grandiose moments, I considered things like kidnapping people from their homes at 6 in the morning while dressed in police uniform as a way to simulate what it might actually be like. People who watch television will have seen some of the tricks cops use. Good cop, bad cop is still in use, even though it's a cliche. So is the cops acting like they have far more information than they do. Learning about tricks they use is one thing, but recognizing the emotional power these tricks have on someone who is scared, exhausted, confused, and/or inexperienced is a whole other issue. Part of what keeps anarchists from dealing effectively with cops is that we have a strong desire to be honest, stand-up people, to live our ideals, even in some cases to respect the person behind the uniform. Cops, on the other hand, usually feel strongly that it is them against everyone else, and they're validated to do anything to find the bad guys. On top of that, of course, they're trained to notice and manipulate opportunities and weaknesses, while we are mostly used to yelling simplistic slogans and/or arguing points of theory. Us practicing being exhausted, stressed out, maybe conflicted, which is how we usually feel in the middle of significant actions, and still making the decisions we want to make seems like a really good idea to me. One of my more bizarre efforts was studying a mainstream television program for tips and reminders that people could pick up during their entertainment time. The best program I found for this was The Closer, about a detective who's known for getting people to confess and who will lie in all kinds of creative ways to get people to tell their stories. Let me end by saying that in no way am I attempting to excuse anything fucked up that people have done. What I want is more preparation so that we all do less fucked up shit to each other, even when we're in hard places. What's new this week? If the FBI approaches you to become an informant. From CrimeThink, this is a list of questions about what it means to inform and how the informing doesn't make you safe. Even people who already know they don't want to talk to the authorities can gain from reading this fact. It's super easy to say, I would never do that, and a lot more complicated to deal with the fear and isolation of actually being arrested or under suspicion. This particular pamphlet is more rhetorical than it needs to be, but the more concrete, specific reminders we have on how to not only not speak to the cops of whatever flavor, but how not to speak to them, the better. Quote, question, is the FBI obligated to give me what they offer when they are trying to get me to inform? Answer, this is a gray area. Federal agents may offer formal informants a written agreement that is supposedly enforceable like a contract, but the FBI is obviously the more powerful party in this negotiation, with little to lose from failing to follow through. Law enforcement officers often maintain a network of unregistered informants whose testimony is not used in court, but rather provide tips and useful information to aid in investigations. Many informants think they will get off for snitching, only to learn later that they still face time for lesser or reduced charges. In short, the FBI cares about repressing communities and disrupting social movements, not about protecting informants. Question, can't I just feed them false information to keep them off my back? Answer, 18 USC-1000 makes it a federal crime to knowingly mislead or lie to federal officials, including law enforcement. Federal agents have used this law to prosecute those they suspect of domestic terrorism when they have no other evidence to go on. Remember, if law enforcement is looking for informants, there is a good chance they don't have a case against whomever they're trying to target. Don't give them a case against you. Unquote. Another good text is the Anarchist Survival Guide pamphlet by Harold Thompson.
Anarchism, Work, Bureaucracy. This is a piece from Eurozine, which has the tagline, quote, Europe's leading cultural magazine at your fingertips, unquote. It's an interview with David Graeber, noted anarchist anthropologist, author, and Occupy celebrity. Here he talks a bit about actions in the past 8 years or so, increasing militarization in everyone's life, and trends in work. Quote, question, in addition to international pressure, you also argue that people are kept in the neoliberal system by ideology, particularly when it comes to the morality of debt and the morality of work. There's been quite a bit of discussion about the morality of debt, so let's take the morality of work. Why is this an important issue in the struggle for direct democracy? Answer, that's what I'm working on right now. In 2013, I wrote an essay titled On the Phenomena of Bullshit Jobs, which turned out to be the most successful thing I've written. It was based on a very common experience. I don't really go to cocktail parties, but when I do, I tend to run into at least one person who doesn't like to talk about their job. So I explain that I'm an anthropologist, and I do field work in Madagascar, and they're all very interested. But when we start talking about their work, they quickly change the subject. And finally, after they've had a few drinks, they say, don't tell my boss, but I kind of don't do anything. They're these mid-level managers who present charts at meetings, but actually, nobody wants to attend these meetings, and nothing really changes as a result. So I call these kinds of jobs bullshit jobs, unquote.
Get to know an anarchist. For mainstream paper, the Portland Mercury, an alternative weekly paper in Oregon, this is a fairly straightforward set of outsider/beginner questions posed to an arrestee from May Day in Portland. Quote, journalist, anonymous people breaking windows does look scary, though. Anarchist, that's the thing, though. They can look at U.S. Special Forces doing that in another country and go, ah, freedom! They can look at previous social revolutions in this country and say, good job, but no more is needed. They're not realizing they're seeing the Boston Tea Party happen again. They can't make that connection. I understand why it's frightening to them, because they're unable to make the connection on how it's been acceptable in their eyes before and why it's not now. Capitalism has done a really good job imparting in their minds that property is an extension of themselves. People confuse private property and personal property. Capitalism has suggested when you damage someone's property, you damage them, so you're doing violence against them. It's a ridiculous hypocrisy they're totally blind to. I get that we look like these ISIS ninjas and we're smashing stuff, but people aren't paying attention to what's being smashed. If you smash up a mom and pop shop, that's class treachery. They're not paying attention to what's being smashed. They don't care that Target exploits its workers. Unquote.
Anarchists fill services void left by faltering Greek governance. This is from the New York Times. This is a not unsympathetic, link-filled article that prominently features a member of the Void Network. Hello, Tassos. Quote, 7 years of austerity policies and a more recent refugee crisis has left the government with fewer and fewer resources, offering citizens less and less. Many have lost faith. Some who never had faith in the first place are taking matters into their own hands, to the chagrin of the authorities. Tasso Sagris, a 45-year-old member of the Greek anarchist group Void Network and of the self-organized Embros Theater Group, has been at the forefront of a resurgence of social activism that is effectively filling a void in governance. "People trust us because we don't use the people as customers or voters," Tasso said. "Every failure of the system proves the ideas of the anarchists to be true. These days, that idea is not only about chaos and tearing down the institutions of the state and society. The country's long, grinding economic crisis has taken care of much of that, but also about unfiltering self-help and citizen action. Yet the movement remains desperate, with some parts emphasizing the need for social activism and others prioritizing a struggle against authority with acts of vandalism and street battles with the police. Some are seeking to combine both," unquote.
The Red and the Rainbow, The Life and Work of Daniel Guérin. Dissent, quote, "A Quarterly of Politics and Ideas," unquote, provides this glowing biographical piece on Guérin, the French author probably best known to U.S. anarchists as the author of No Gods, No Masters, a huge anthology of anarchist writings from the 1830s to World War II by classic anarchists. The anthology is partly notable for including a fairly wide array of anarchist perspectives, but this Dissent article mentions many more of Guérin's works. Quote, "His penchant for seeking openings for the left in difficult circumstances may also be what inspired him to travel to the U.S. soon after the war, an unusual move for a French socialist at the time. European radicals in the immediate post-war years tended to view the States as a kind of wasteland for the left. Guérin was drawn to it, likely for this very reason. A two-year trip in the late 1940s gave him the sort of broad political insights about the U.S. that foreigners seemed more predisposed to reach than its native inhabitants. Guérin originally published his findings in a two-volume collection entitled Where Are the American People Going?, released in 1950 and 1951. Parts of these were later translated and published as Negroes on the March, A Frenchman's Report on the American Negro Struggle, updated and published under the more provocative title Decolonization of Black America in 1963, and 100 Years of Labor in the United States of America, unquote.
A Recipe for Nocturnal Direct Actions, from Montreal Counterinformation. This is a how-to guide for doing extra-legal stuff. Quote, "Expect to be seen on camera during the action. Don't get too paranoid about cameras in the surrounding area. A standard CCTV camera has poor resolution in the dark. If police even bother to get the footage before it's overwritten automatically, all surfaces and any tools you'll be using should be thoroughly wiped with rubbing alcohol ahead of time to remove fingerprints, and cotton gloves should be used during the action. Leather and nylon will retain your fingerprints on the inside. Do not take your cell phone, or if you must, remove the battery. It geolocates even when powered off," unquote. There are lots of cute pictures to inspire you.
Burn Down the American Plantation, Announcing the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM. From revolutionaryabolition.org, this announcement sounds like some previous organizations that took anti-racism as the main anarchist fight worth waging, notably the Ruckus Society that was mostly out of Arizona. Quote, "Short-term goal, the Underground Railroad. We will create networks for those facing detention, incarceration, deportation, or white supremacist violence to escape and live with dignity. We invite revolutionaries to help build a contemporary Underground Railroad outside the reach of the state. Revolutionaries, social centers, and Antifa groups that are already active can help build greater infrastructure of resistance to support these fleeing the state. From this foundation, we set the political framework for the next stages. Long-term goal, building the abolitionist project. For the abolitionist project to be successful, we must eventually transition from resistance to a revolutionary situation. Relationships and groups built through the Underground Railroad have the potential to become the foundation for organized defense groups, local councils, and regional national councils," unquote.
Forest Friends, Get a Circle, a Clue. Also from Montreal Counterinformation, quote, "June 11th, International Day of Solidarity with Narius Mason and all long-term anarchist prisoners, is less than a month away. Montreal will be participating by having a board game night featuring ELF edition of Clue, June 11th, La Déferlée at 7 p.m. Forest Friends, Get a Clue is a game where players try to figure out the three main facts of an attack against industrial civilization. The attacker, animal, the location of the attack, and the weapon used in the attack. We do this so the animal can be celebrated by all their fellow forest friends, because there are no forest cops who wants to imprison these comrades for their brave actions in this imaginary world. Rather than the library, you have the Vail Mountain Ski Resort. Rather than the dagger, you've got gasoline and matches. We've made the game printable in case other cities want to host similar events, or you just want another way to teach kids this important history, unquote.
Metropolis by Strange Command. Subtitled, quote, a deconstruction manual, unquote, this is a manifesto that was published on the anarchistlibrary.org. The metropolitan doctrine is, quote, a way of looking at life from an urban perspective. This is the perspective largely represented in historical philosophy because the philosophers have always been city folk, unquote. Quote, while the convenient notion that we have a duty to, quote, civilize indigenous and isolated people has waned in its more vulgar forms, it continues in the belief that we do the righteous thing by spreading Western-style liberal democracy and Western values, moral, economic, and social, to the rest of the world. Of course, even when it is born of war, it is not seen as imposition. It is seen as giving them something that they have an innate desire for. In some cases, the desire is indeed present, particularly in moderately industrialized nations with a history of totalitarian rule. But the metropolis doctrine is not God-given, is not a proven, infallible, universal ideal, and should not be envisaged as such. Naturally, it suits state and capital that the rest of the world should follow along, because then they have more pockets to dig into, more lives to control, and more friends to play with. But the average Afghan farmer who finds himself in the middle of a war for his soul could give as little as a fuck about liberal democracy as he does the Salafism of the Taliban. He just wants to be left alone, unquote.
Anarchist call against the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, from 325. This announcement of actions against the July 7th and 8th G20, quote, since Seattle in 1999, summit protests were a catalyzer of radical resistance. Individuals and groups came together, swapped ideas, were standing together behind the barricades, and carried the flame of resistance back to their regions. Even the shots of Gothenburg and Genoa, where the numerous infiltrated snitches could not stop the development of a Europe-wide chaotic network of autonomous anarchist anti-authoritarian tendencies. Then the critic had pleaded for it to operate as a riot tourist in any city. The protests against the G20 in Cannes and Nice, 2011, were prepared in the champagne flush of some movement managers. Everything should become different, better, more political. At that time, no conclusion or analysis was spread afterwards. The resistance had simply failed. Only the usual alibi NGOs played their program. End quote.
When concerns of cultural appropriation risk supporting intellectual property. This article comes from C4SS, a market anarchist website, and is written by William Gillis, a market anarcho-transhumanist and one of the main voices in the podcast Horizontal Hostility. This article starts from the phenomenon of restaurants being called out for cultural appropriation, for example, white people taking information from their vacations back to restaurants in Portland, and moves on to a discussion of two topics Gillis feels strongly about, racism and intellectual property. He's against both. Quote, as an anarchist, I don't swallow the poisonous quick fix of backing smaller nations against bigger ones. Trying to equalize power relations is ultimately no fix for power relations themselves. The goal is liberation from power relations, not equal constraint under them. We believe in backing individuals in rebellion against their nations and tearing down all borders. There's certainly a place for, don't be a racist douche canoe, recognize the symbolism and perceptions broadly at play in cultural artifacts as a result of institutional racism, in no small part because attentiveness to the unique experiences and trauma of other people is deeply in line with the ideals of freedom of information. But at the end of the day, anarchism means being culture traitors, or it means nothing. We long for a day when cultural miscegenation has proceeded until culture is impossible to be differentiated into distinct cultures, when culture is a fluid mess to be splashed about in, not something that constrains or defines us, unquote. Perhaps a deeper understanding of racism is on order?
Territory, presence, and building a base of support. From and by IGD, this is a tract that supports anarchists as guerrillas and remarks on the need for, as Mao put it, a sea for the fishes to live in. Mao's quotation was, quote, many people think it is impossible for guerrillas to exist for long in the enemy's rear. Such a belief reveals lack of comprehension of the relationship that should exist between the people and the troops. The former may be likened to water, the latter to the fish who inhabit it. How may it be said that these two cannot exist together? Unquote. From the article, here's a bit of what they have to say about territory. Quote, there's a reason that neo-Nazi groups like Identity Europa base a lot of their activity off of putting up stickers and posters. Graffiti artists pride themselves on the amount of tags they can get up. And Walmart installs video cameras that don't even work. Territory, and the ability to claim it and to control it, is important. But moreover, how you interact with that territory is even more essential. Where are you basing your activity around? Is it a neighborhood? A whole town? A bioregion? A street? A campus? What do you do to claim that territory? How do you interact with the other forces at play within it that are also fighting for control? Be they antisocial elements, the police, business owners, homeowner associations, far-right organizations, gangs, and whoever else, unquote.
Left of the left, my memories of Sam Dolgoff, a book review. From leftist darling The Huffington Post comes this positive review of a new book by Sam Dolgoff's son, Anatole Dolgoff. The book shows the personal side of Dolgoff Sr., his alcoholism, as well as the company of dedicated working anarchists who manage to work full-time jobs, have families, and be active, thoughtful anarchists in their off hours. The review mentions nothing about Dolgoff's particular kind of anarchist thought, he was an anarchist syndicalist, and doesn't make it sound like the biography by his son has much grounding in anarchist thinking of any kind, although it does mention Anatole liked some of the anarchists he met as a kid. Perhaps those extra paragraphs were cut out by our friendly Bibbles at the Huff.
J20 benefit t-shirts. Black Powder Press offers a t-shirt, sales of which will benefit those arrested at Trump's inauguration event. Quote, imagine if everyone in the vicinity of an Occupy or Black Lives Matter demonstration, at which a little property destruction took place, had been charged with 8 felonies. Thousands of people would have charges now. If the prosecution is able to set this precedent for blanket intimidation and collective punishment, it will mark a significant step in the rise of tyranny. Unquote. To buy a shirt, go to blackpowderpress.com.
Media projects. Free radio, Free Radical Radio. Gender nihilism and plagiarism. Free Radical Radio moves from podcast to media this week, partly because recordings of writings seems more like a media project, and partly because they also announce a written piece about plagiarism, available on their website. From that article, quote, our tradition of recognizing intellectual property rights is dangerous in that it results in the deification of the publicly recognized thinker and artist at the expense of everyone else. When ideas are always associated with proper names, and always the same proper names in point of fact, this suggests that thinking and creating are special skills that belong to a select few individuals. For example, the glorification of the artist in our culture, which includes the stereotyping of artists as eccentric visionaries who exist at the edge, the avant-garde of society, encourages people to believe that artists are significantly and fundamentally different from other human beings. Actually, anyone can be an artist, and everyone is to some extent. Being able to act creatively is a crucial element of human happiness. But when we are led to believe that being creative and thinking critically are talents that only a few individuals possess, those of us who are not fortunate enough to be Christian artists or philosophers by our communities will not make much effort to develop those abilities. Consequently, we will be dependent upon others for many of our ideas and will have to be content as spectators of the creative work of others, and we will feel alienated and unsatisfied. Unquote.
Anathema, Volume 3, Issue 4. Anathema, which names itself as a Philadelphia-based anarchist periodical, announces a new issue. The table of contents lists many articles that have already appeared on eNews, from the piece about anarchists destroying Olympia to Paul Simon's essay on the new pure black anarchist tendency. There are also writings on local politics, solidarity with anarchist political prisoners, gentrification, etc. One fun addition is a column called Health is in You, about the original publication by Luigi Galliani that shows how to make bombs. Quote, contemporary anarchists the world over have had similar discussions on disseminating the means to safely produce explosive and incendiary devices in recent years in an attempt to proliferate these means to escalate conflict and the effectiveness of their actions, unquote.
Montreal counter-info number two. From Montreal counter-information, which says about itself, quote, autonomous communication for the struggle against authority, unquote, this is issue two in a PDF of their publication. Contents include stories posted to ANews before, like a recipe for nocturnal direct action article mentioned previously, as well as a piece on legalization of weed, anti-gentrification actions, a broken kettle on March 15th in Montreal, Antifa actions, tips for protest and communiques, etc. Also, there's a centerfold for the board game mentioned above, Forest Friends Get a Circle A Clue.
Podcasts. The Anarchists, Episode 9. Rogue Hacking Tools, The New War on Drugs, and Sociocracy. This episode hosts are Prince, Hermes, and Warlord, Mass Effect game references by hackers, assigning blame for vulnerabilities of the U.S. military, how the military could fix their security problems, because apparently that's what anarchists want, conflict between defense and offense roles, changes in drug laws, politicians are bad, sociocracy as a concept and an option instead of consensus for decision-making. This was discussed entirely as an online issue. The host's subreddit is Anarchism Online.
Anarchy Radio for May 23, 2017. Manchester bombing is a tragedy. Really funny joke about ITS doing it. LBC bad for publishing ATASA. Mark Boyle, great anti-civ stuff published in The Guardian. Environmental projections aren't keeping up with the reality of disasters. One caller. Apparently it's preferable for the environment to kill people to make change rather than people killing people to make change. Critiques IGD as leftist for articles that rile up people with inflationary rhetoric rather than focusing on what goes on every day. People shouldn't be depressed. They should create things that are worthy of something.
Topic of the week. How do we build trust at a distance? For better or for worse, the internet has become an essential tool for communication among anarchists. Traditionally, anarchists have relied on face-to-face interactions and local social centers to build trust and solidarity. Yet, our communities are now sparse and spread thin. Aside from the obvious security concerns due to infiltration when we are involved with the struggle, there is no popular alternative to the ritual of establishing rapport in localized ways. As the scope of our community continues to move to more and more national and international scales, there is great need to discover innovative ways to build trust and rapport without the luxury of shared geography. When personal friends and family are met with significant separation through a move or some other circumstance, they usually have regular phone calls, email lists, or even video conferences. However, for anarchists, using these tools can provide channels for unwanted and unwarranted attention and monitoring. How, at great distance and without frequent physical contact, can anarchists build trust and rapport? In a culture where infiltration is a legitimate concern, how can we establish reciprocal trust without relying on the rituals of in-person communication? I mean, I basically think the answer is we can.
I
try to maintain a set of about a half dozen people who I have like a phone call a month with, but outside of that, if you're not in my space,
yeah, I can't even manage that. So
yeah, so you'd say that for you it's basically out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, because I don't really get along with very many people, so you know, it means that the group of people that I can actually find commonalities with just is smaller and smaller. And yeah.
Was that also the case before you were an anarchist? In other words, did you ever have pen pals or people you kept in contact with?
I always had a really hard time keeping in contact with people. I moved a couple times, like 3-4 times in my life. And each time was a pretty significant move in terms of, you know, how long I had known people. And, you know, friendships are very hard to build but very easy to lose. Yeah. And that's pretty much what I found happening was every time I moved, I'd say, wow, I'm really going to keep in touch with this person. you know, they're very important in my life, but when it came down to it, life gets in the way and you just, you can't have a personal relationship when you're far away from people.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there is that definition of like what's an anarchist relationship like? And I think that for a lot of people, they're the high point of their anarchist relationships. Like for about 5 years here in the Bay Area, there were about 20 people who more or less met and knew each other through going to the RNC in 2008 together. And their relationships very much like were fueled and were fired by that intense period of time together. And so for them, they could still sort of be connected, but not necessarily in the same geography. But I think that in general, you just have to have face-to-face to maintain a meaningful relationship.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is meaningful. Because, I mean, I think it's possible to, there's a million ways we can keep up with people these days, like Facebook or any number of the social media platforms, but it's also superficial. And, you know, so is keep building a relationship and maintaining it based on, you know, something that you had say, you know, being involved in a street battle or something. Like, that only goes so far, you know, if you're not staying together or if you're not working on projects together or if you don't have anything else to hold up that relationship. I just don't see it going very far.
You have, like, 10 to 20 people who you're very friendly with on Facebook. I mean, would you say you have anything like trust with any of them?
No, because I don't know them. You know, and it's weird because you're all, you know, at least I don't post as much as I used to, but certainly, you know, you can get, you can just talk about personal things that you maybe won't talk about with other people just because you feel, you know.
Like there's a removal.
Yeah, there's a removal. And so I think some people mistake that for maybe trusting people because they'll say things that are personal, but, you know, I wouldn't trust them any deeper than, you know, meeting someone on the street, you know. Right. I know them as much as this person on Facebook.
Yeah. They just happen to agree with you on a whole bunch of checkboxes.
Right. Right.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't think that there's any hope for the future either. I mean, by and large, you know, when people talk about their experiences online and when I see the things play out that do, it doesn't seem like it's going to get better or like it's going to become easier to become close to people via that medium.
Yeah, it seems like communities people attempt to build just are shattered so easily by interpersonal dramas or conflicts. And, you know, if you can't get beyond some basic you know, something where you have, like, you know this person, you want to continue building a relationship with them. Mm-hmm. Sorry, my train of thought drifted off.
Do you usually read the topic of the weeks?
No.
Why not?
I've just been focusing on my own stuff now, I guess.
So do you read e-news headlines at all?
I skim them. I usually see the news before it gets put on. Not to sound all hipster, but I usually see the news before it gets put on A-News, and I can't say that I, you know, I just don't go on there as often as I used to.
You don't read the comments?
Very infrequently. Probably because of, you know, you've seen one Emil post or, you know, Sir Isaac post, and you kind of, it does turn you off a little bit to sort of, and you know, it's my fault too for not contributing my own comments and stuff, so, but it's a time thing.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Get off the internet. We are the ones who are alive right now, so let's start living. We're obsessed with freedom and living easy lives. But what use is an easy life, hungry and blind? The hollow.
The weekly Anarchy 101 question and some answers. In this segment, we take questions and some of the answers and responses from the website anarchy101.org.
This is a user-moderated Q&A site for anarchists to answer questions on anarchist thought and activity. This week's question is, all else being equal, isn't violence inherently antithetical to anarchism? The rest of the question goes, generally things aren't equal, but even if they were, doesn't violence by one person against an equal imply your power over them and thus a basic kind of hierarchical relationship? Assuming the answer is yes, and taking this a bit further, if you're using violence in the struggle against a more powerful adversary and you win, didn't you just become the more powerful one, and aren't you now at the top of a hierarchy? If the answer is no, violence against an equal or less powerful adversary isn't hierarchical, then why is hierarchy bad? Answer number one. Violence is a pretty loaded word. The violence of me punching you in the nose is a pretty different creature than the violence of dropping a bomb on a village or starving a category of humans. The family of ideas and activities the term implies make it pretty unusable during most conversations that anarchists would want to have about a better world, about anarchist ideas, or about how to get there. To the extent that a conversation about anarchy is an introduction to a body of ideas, then obviously the first ones aren't necessarily going to be about conflict resolution, but eventually they will be. The instinct that people have to want to punch each other in the nose is a pretty strong one, perhaps even a fundamental one. If, or since, that is the case, then violence is part of being a person. The desire for violence, the belief that something is solved with interpersonal violence, is probably part of the human project. If violence is human and the desire to live without coercion and power over is human, then the only thing that is antithetical to humans is humans, which is probably a fair assessment of our current condition. One last note. Bolo Bolo, the book, has a nice section about conflict in a different world that might be worth quoting. Very briefly, quote, Yaka, every Ibu individual can challenge any other Ibu or a larger community to a duel, according to those rules, end quote. It may be possible to agree to terms by which conflict is human scale, and perhaps includes consensual violence. Next answer. While institutionalized power over is antithetical to anarchy, I don't agree that any power over is. Some of the conflict here comes from the understanding of power over as a negative or threatening thing. But in my life, there are many forms of power over me that I want. I have friends who are smart and socially connected, and their acceptance is important to me. I have lovers who I feel drawn towards and desire to be taken over by. I have working relationships that expect of me commitment if I am to stay involved. I have physical limitations that I have to find ways to work around. All of these things exert manipulative and some physical power over me, but I enjoy them and I improve and expand myself because of them. My personal history also includes a number of violent intimate relationships. There are times I have been hit that were far less damaging than some of the things people have said to me, or the way context in which they said them. I think this ties into the issue that Dot brought up. What kinds of influences over us are we okay with, and not okay with, and why? I agree with the first answer, that the desire for violence is a human one, and a part of the human project. In anarchy, violence might be added to the list of types of power over that could be enjoyable, productive, inspirational. When violence did not evoke the power overs of bureaucracy, policing, gender, race, access to food, water, shelter, medical care, etc., then it would be different. Physical violence might end up in the long and confusing list of influences like chemistry, charisma, obsession, and so on that give force and direction to our individual experience. As always, if you don't like these answers or have your own question to ask, visit anarchy101.org and join the conversation. This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel, written by Jackie, produced and narrated by Aragorn and Chisel. And we thank Stephanie for the help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, books, pamphlets, and other anarchist material, go to littleblackcart.com. And for news and up-to-the-minute commentary, go to anarchistnews.org.